Ah, poor Joseph. That dude really never had a chance, did he?
Still, Jay, you gotta admit, dying for Xavier's dream is a pretty poetic way to go when you're a clone of Magneto.
Well, yeah, if you stay dead.
Wait, Joseph comes back?
Several times.
How?
Well, initially Astra again.
Okay, so does Joseph rejoin the X-Men?
No, he clones himself a new Brotherhood of Evil Mutants.
What?!
I'm Jay Editon.
And I'm Miles Stokes.
And we are here to explain the X-Men.
Because it's about time someone did.
Welcome to episode 446 of Jay and Miles Explain the X-Men, where we walk you through the ins, the outs, and the retcons of comics' greatest superhero soap opera.
And welcome to episode 2 of our two-part coverage of the Magneto War.
You might want to go back and listen to episode 445 if you haven't, but honestly, not a huge amount happens, and we're pretty much going to cover it all in the next minute or so you do you.
It'll be fine. Anyway, that was a week ago. A lot can happen in a week.
Countries can rise or fall. Magneto can get cloned.
Cloned left and right. But before then, okay, so way back in the Fatal Attractions crossover of the early 90s, Magneto was put into a seemingly permanent vegetative state by Professor X, who had hoped to stop his old frenemy's crimes against the world once and for all.
Sometime later, Magneto disappeared when his space station got knocked out of orbit by a flaming skeleton guy from another timeline.
It's a long story. Don't worry about that part.
Thankfully, Magneto survived, or appeared to have survived, in the form of an amnesiac younger version of himself named Joseph, who joined the X-Men to try to atone for crimes he couldn't remember.
Except, no, Joseph really wasn't Magneto. Joseph was a clone. And at this point in the story, he's been captured by a woman we know nothing about named Astra, who claims to have created him.
So that accounts for Joseph. What about the original Magneto?
The original Magneto has his mind back somehow and has declared war on humanity yet again. This time, he's demanded his own country to use as a mutant safe haven, lest he destroy the Earth's electromagnetic field and basically destroy civilization worldwide.
It would be really funny if they gave him, like, Andorra or Luxembourg.
Or what's that, Sealand? Like, that tiny little floating country?
Oh, man. Yeah, yes. I don't know if that counts. I don't think that's really a country.
I don't know. Is it still around? I don't know anything about Sealand. I haven't thought about Sealand in years. Sorry, Sealand. I forgot about you.
Sealand, somewhere out there listening, has never stopped thinking of you. But its thoughts have turned from love to revenge.
Oh shit, they're going to be inspired by this episode, and there's going to be the Sealand War. They're going to destroy Earth's oceanosphere.
That would be really bad, actually.
Oh, it'd be terrible. Sealand, please, have mercy.
Anyway, after a brief tussle with Magneto's cult-like flunkies, the Acolytes, the X-Men are in hot pursuit. Especially hot since Alan Davis does some of the art in this story, and we know that Alan Davis draws the sexiest X-Men. But, like, the actually sexiest, not just the most sexualized.
Right, important distinction. Those sexy X-Men at this point consist of Storm, Wolverine, Rogue, Gambit, Nightcrawler, Colossus, Shadowcat, and Marrow, along with Professor X, back after a long absence.
Which brings us to Magneto War, Part 2. Just as long as Part 1, with just as little to show for it.
But we have a lot to discuss because we're us, and man, we never shut up. So let's start with X-Men number 86, Thanks for the Memories. With a plot by Alan Davis, a script by Fabian Nicieza, pencils by Alan Davis, inks by Mark Farmer, colors by Liquid Graphics, and letters by Richard Starkings and Comicraft and Wes Abbott. Man, Alan Davis's art, I never get tired of it. I never, ever get tired of it. And we've seen him draw some of these characters before. I mean, he drew Nightcrawler and Shadowcat, like, a ton back in Excalibur. This is one of the first times we've seen him draw Marrow, though, and I really like his Marrow. Like, she's all skinny and bony, like she looks like someone who's been living underground for a long time, who hasn't seen the sun, who probably hasn't had enough to eat. I always appreciate when female comics characters get to be drawn as ugly when they're described that way, to actually be drawn to look that way. I know we've harped on this a number of times with Callisto and stuff, but it remains true.
Yeah, his Marrow is extremely gnarly, and it's extremely good.
Anyway, remember that lady who called herself Joseph's mother and knocked Joseph out back in Israel? let's learn a lot more about her, because right now she has Joseph captive and shirtless in a structure made of tentacly goo. Huh.
Now, this lady is a fancy retcon.
Oh, she totally is. And I mean, fancy's a right word. Like, she's wearing this tight bodysuit of sort of exotic-looking silver and black and purple and green. Everything's all Alan Davis sleek and attractive. She's not actually Joseph's mother, by the way. Otherwise, just how sexy this scene is getting would be, like, even more awkward.
It's still real awkward.
It is. Yeah, Astra's, I mean, she's fun, but she's awful.
She's basically Mallory Archer.
She's basically Mallory Archer. Yeah. Just one of those characters where you're like, you're the worst, but because you're a fictional character, I deeply enjoy you.
Yeah, no, she's very, very entertainingly terrible, but she's just mercilessly mean to Joseph. Like, way, way beyond the I'm the mad scientist who created you. She's just, at some point she tells him that she cares about his dreams as much as she cares about her VCRs.
Oh, that would explain why his eyes are always flashing 12 o'clock, 12 o'clock, 12 o'clock.
Oh, shit. It would be very funny if he had an internal clock that she just never bothered to program.
Right? And I mean, like, shit. Like, she's very inconsiderate. I bet she wouldn't even rewind him before returning him to the store.
That's a VCR tape, Miles, not a VCR.
He's both. He's his own VCR and his own VCR tape. He's the whole package.
Like Jason Funderburker.
Like Jason Funderburker. Oh, anyway, we'll get to Astra more personality-wise, but we do learn a bit about who the hell this lady is. Because remember, the last time we saw her, she was just random lady in power suit that knocked Joseph out. Like, we knew nothing about her.
I just realized something. She's the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants, forget-me-not.
She is, because that's the deal. Apparently, she was one of the original Brotherhood of Evil Mutants. You know, that we never, ever saw in a comic before. Because I guess she, like, left before. Before then?
Yeah, she left the team before their first comic book appearance.
Right. Which is pretty impressive, because that was a very long time ago, and you get the impression Magneto had just assembled the Brotherhood.
Apparently she had a couple weeks to grow disenchanted with them and increasingly angrily horny for Magneto and then storm off.
That's actually a pretty concise and accurate summation of the whole thing. Like, yeah, she was into Magneto, he was a jerk, she said screw this, left, traveled through time and space, kind of like that Snow White lady from Generation X, Bianca LaNege, like who had all these adventures that we just never heard about. I get the impression Astra did the same thing, because now she's got a ton of alien technology from all over the galaxy, and I think all through the time stream as well. Like, she's had this whole rich life that we will just never learn anything about.
A rich life tainted by the fact that its entire driving premise was to get revenge on Magneto for being kind of an ass.
Right. Like, I guess, though, you can take a couple directions there. You can either say, screw this, like the Maximoff siblings. You can say, yes, master, I'm just going to attempt to be as, you know, henchman-ish as possible in hopes of scraps of approval, like Toad. Or you can be like Astra and go have your own adventures, which will only serve for you to appear in, like, one story to try to kill your old boss.
Or you can be Mastermind and just suck.
Mastermind's the freaking worst. You remember that time he died of the Legacy Virus and the comic was trying to humanize him and we're just like, yeah, but Mastermind.
Remember how the Executioner was trying to kill him at the same time?
Oh, yeah. Good old Carl. Anyway, Astra, right. So, Joseph has some memories of Astra as well that are starting to come back thanks to this weird tentacly machine he's hooked up to.
Right, he remembers crashing into Earth and in an escape pod after Avalon was destroyed by Holocaust and Astra finding him. And Astra's like, no, 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 you don't remember that, honey. That's Magneto's memory that just sort of slipped in when we made you. To which Joseph responds, still incredulous.
You made me?
And not very well, apparently.
And then she just mutters to herself for, like, a long time about all of the wacky science that must have gone wrong to make Joseph suck so much.
Yeah, I feel so bad for Joseph. Like, not only is he in an impossible position, but again, she's just really mean.
Right! Like, between Alan Davis's creation of her deal and Fabian Nicieza's script, she is just so snarky. She kind of reminds me of a cross between, like, Mr. Sinister and Saturnine.
I stand by mad scientist Mallory Archer.
That's probably more accurate, yes, but I think it's all relevant.
I wish I could do a better Jessica Walter voice. I apologize.
Ah, Jessica Walter, taken from us too soon. Like, I know she was pretty old when she died, but I just wanted her to live forever.
Yeah, she could have just kept on playing that character, and also Clea Strange.
Yes, exactly, because fun fact, the old Doctor Strange movie from, like, decades and decades and decades ago, she played freaking Clea.
I haven't seen that movie, and I'd like to think that she basically played her as you know, Lucille Bluth, Mallory Archer.
I haven't seen it since I was a kid, really. The main thing I remember is that Doctor Strange had, like, a pretty awesome mustache.
Good.
Yeah, that's where he keeps all of his spells.
I heard he shaved in the comics, and it's really weirding me out.
Oh, no, don't do that, Steven.
I don't know how long it lasted, but, like, I saw a screen cap, and it was really unsettling.
Oh, boo. This is as bad of an idea as me shaving. Shouldn't happen. So anyway, with a bunch of impressive sci-fi techno-babble, Astra explains to Joseph how she did the thing, how she made a clone of Magneto after finding the actual Magneto who fell to Earth. She talks about Kitlan recall psi-taps, Chimelian matrix buffers. Oh, hey, those are those horse people from Power Pack. Glixian eugenic restorative tanks. Like, she just keeps going. And most of this is nonsense. Like, there are some references, but most of it's nonsense. And I dig that. It really does just speak of all of these, like, wacky galactic journeys she's had that we will just never learn about.
Now, before she cloned Magneto, she had to fix his mind, or Joseph would have woken up equivalently vegetative. So this is some weird cloning. This doesn't make any sense, but that's fine. So she did this. And then when Magneto woke up, Astra immediately ordered the newborn and mindless Joseph to beat him down and kill him.
And that didn't work because Magneto did have a great deal more experience, even if Joseph had more raw power by virtue of being younger and not having any self-preservation. So Magneto whomps Joseph on the back of the head, and Joseph fell into a jungle and was knocked out for days, during which time he grew a giant beard, like a giant Santa Claus beard in a matter of days. I'm kind of reminded of Gordito from the old comic Dr. McNinja, who grew a mustache through sheer force of will.
Well, see, I think that this is the power of magnetism.
You know, okay, no, that makes sense. He just, you know, took the ambient iron in the air and had it transform into, like, you know, iron molecules of something-something giant beard.
Actually, the beard does kind of make sense, and I can no-prize it, but it involves spoilers for later in this episode.
Okay, well, let's put a pin in that and come back to that beardy plot point.
I will drop this here, though, because Astra mentions, in context of this fight, that the reason Joseph is so much more powerful than Magneto is that most mutants develop natural, basically, lids to their power level that exist to keep their powers from consuming them. And
exactly.
Yeah. And Magneto has that. And Joseph does not. Joseph does not have that innate protection. This is sort of like the same reason that most humans won't, like, I don't know. I'm trying to think of ways you could injure yourself doing a basic action. But yeah, most humans won't, like, kick the air hard enough while practicing to dislocate their hips.
True. Although I did have a martial arts instructor once who did that to his shoulder.
Yeah, that's why I went with a kick.
Oh, yeah, fair. Yeah. So, that's Joseph. That's his deal. He was just a younger clone, amnesiac, because, as Astra puts it,
because, frankly, he can be such a dullard.
And without those limiters, she created a version of Magneto to kill Magneto because she was so pissed at her old boss. That's very specific revenge.
It is, and now she's really pissed off that Joseph not only didn't finish off Magneto, but went and joined the X-Men and tried to become a hero.
I love her comment here.
Now I appreciate why the Geldanabians practice infanticide.
I mean, the episode isn't just going to be Astra quotes, but we do have some. What about the X-Men, though? This is an X-Men book, right?
Well, you mentioned they were in hot water earlier, that they were having a hot time. And I almost corrected you there, because what the X-Men did most recently before the plot that we started in this episode was to crash land their plane in the Arctic. They are very cold.
They are, yeah. They've been chasing after the Acolytes, and it's gone poorly. Gambit mentions he's had enough of wandering through the snow, because you remember the X-Men abandoned him in the Antarctic not too long ago?
Yeah, he had to get saved by a fart ghost.
Sure did.
A romantic fart ghost.
It's a whole thing. So, yeah, they're just sitting here trying to survive. One little touch I appreciate is that Mero tries to get close to Colossus for warmth, but he's in his metal form, so he accidentally shocks her, because, like, there's a magnetic storm going around. He is a magnetic conductor. I guess it only would have been worse if he'd also been shuffling his feet on carpet the whole time.
Yes, the famous carpet of the Arctic. Nightcrawler takes that moment to attempt to stay warm with humor.
That doesn't come as a shock to me. Storm's a little annoyed.
Kurt, is this the best time for jokes?
So, time for a plan. Nightcrawler and Wolverine try to teleport up to the Acolyte's airship to take them out and find some shelter, but the storm, what with its magnetic stuff, is messing with Nightcrawler's ability to teleport, his, like, teleportation proprioception. Nightcrawler refuses Wolverine's suggestion to teleport again. He justifies it as...
And risk appearing inside the wreckage? Or a fellow X-Man's body?
Some interesting possibilities there, huh?
Is this really the time for jokes?
Innuendo in my X-Men comic? Well, I never. Anyway, they keep trying to figure out what to do. At one point, Rogue flies into the storm to try to help out, but she gets electromagnetics down to the ground and her costume is shredded, so, take a drink.
Now, Joseph is not the only character who is in their second or so iteration in this issue. Because watching them from above are the Acolytes, and one of them is Mellencamp, whom we literally saw explode in his last appearance.
Yeah, like he bit Multiple Man way back in X-Factor, and so from the impact, Multiple Man created a dupe inside Mellencamp, and then Mellencamp exploded into lizard bits. But I guess he's fine. Like, I know lizards can regrow their tails. Can they regrow their everything?
I don't know. Everything I know about that comes from a Madeline L'Engle novel.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man, I haven't read any L'Engle in a long time. She's so great.
She really is.
It's not just Mellencamp that's back. Also, Senyaka's back. Senyaka, at this point, by the way, has died twice. So, yes, we have Mellencamp Part 2, Senyaka Part 3. This makes me feel really bad for the Kleinstock brothers. They're these two twin brothers that used to be... Well, I mean, they are triplets, I guess, still, technically. But one of the triplets died. And it's like, really, Marvel, you could resurrect Senyaka twice, but you couldn't give the Kleinstocks their third brother back after all this time?
No.
Well... Professor X tries to telepathically beg the Acolytes to just stop, because the path that everyone's on, them and Magneto, it's going to lead to global war.
The Acolytes are not interested, and in particular, Scanner, who is one of the nicer Acolytes, along with Neophyte, is furious because Xavier turned them all over to the authorities last time when he could have given her a place to belong.
Yeah, you really get the impression that Scanner's only with the Acolytes because she just wanted, like, someone to accept her, and she wanted a home, she wanted a family, and obviously the X-Men are a way better plan than the Acolytes in that regard. The Acolytes are not entirely awful, but largely awful.
They're periodically run by Fabian Cortez, which is never, ever, ever a good sign.
The fact that he's able to run the Acolytes more than once, even though he fucks it up horrifically and is revealed to be a traitor, like, every single time, really makes me question that organization's judgment.
I mean, it's pretty accurately reflective of powerful men failing up.
True, you know? God grant me the confidence of a mediocre ponytailed white man.
Mediocre Fabian Cortez.
Yup.
But I guess that's kind of redundant.
So Scanner uses her powers that she's been practicing and are now better to slam Professor X's astral form out of the plane from the bottom left panel of a page and back into his body on the ground in the bottom right panel of a page. It's a nice little bit of panel staging there.
It really is. I mean, Davis, he's always been really, really good at, like, the physicality of comics.
Very much so, yeah. Yeah, his comics feel very tactile. So that's happening in the Arctic. Real Magneto, meanwhile... We last left him in a big old techno tower in the Arctic Circle, shooting, like, electromagnetic stuff into Earth's magnetosphere to fuck it all up, and he's still doing that. He is currently in full perception and full control of anything that interacts with the EM field on Earth, or at least all of the technology. And, man, it looks cool. Like, the art goes from him all tensing his impressive muscles, because, again, Alan Davis, and exerting himself, and it zooms out to his giant glowing blue science machine that he's in, and zooms out even more to this orange energy flare that pierces the sky from the tower and out even more to the whole surface of the earth that's flaring golden yellow. One thing that this arc has been very good at, like, I know we've been critical of a lot of aspects of it, but it's so good at just showing the sense of scale of the threat Magneto represents.
Now, unfortunately for both Magneto and the Earth, the world already has a lot of countries, and some of them have very, very itchy trigger fingers.
So Russia decides to send its supply of Magneto-seeking nuclear missiles to blow him up. And they do. And the tower is hit, and a shockwave expands outward and outward and outward and hits all the X-Men in the Arctic, which means this issue is our second cliffhanger in a row where it looks like all the X-Men have died.
This reminds me of something from the tabletop game HeroQuest.
HeroQuest? I love HeroQuest.
So HeroQuest is a board game. So it's fun. It's very silly. It's not deliberately silly, but it is silly. And it's got hazards, and one of those hazards is a pit trap. And once you fall into a pit trap, you roll again, and you can hit another hazard, including a shallow hole. And the two cliffhangers in a row reminds me of the shallow hole in a pit trap, like the
Exactly. I mean, okay, technically you have to search for, like, treasure to find the shallow hole, but, like, obviously you're going to search everywhere for treasure. It was always so delightful when that happened. Yeah. That game was so simplistic, and I think that's part of why it was so much fun. You kind of had to make your own plot line.
Well, we misplayed it, because it was supposed to be a you-play-to-win game, and we always played it collaboratively, because we were experienced tabletop gamers, and we also always tried to play it like a role-playing game where we made, you know, character choices, which you are absolutely not supposed to do.
Oh, man. I still remember our party, yes.
Yeah.
Anyway, that leads us to Uncanny X-Men number 367, Disturbing Behavior.
This is plotted by Alan Davis with a script by Fabian Nicieza, pencils by Lionel Francis Yu, inks by John Livesay and Dexter Vines, colors by Liquid, and letters by Richard Starkings and Comicraft. And Professor X manages to keep the X-Men safe from the nuclear bombs by telepathically influencing the Acolytes to extend their ship's gravitometric shields. And then he uses that same, you know, telepathic in to convince the Acolytes to abandon their ship and come fight the X-Men in the snow.
Dick move, Professor X. Like, the Acolytes aren't really sure whether they want to fight the X-Men, and he telepathically makes them more aggressive just to get them out of their ship so the X-Men can eventually hijack it. This is after, as we talked about last episode, he refused to take them in to grant them solace at the X-Mansion because he wanted to follow them back to Magneto. Like, Professor X is just so cold and utilitarian at this point.
Funny you mentioned cold, because he is about to abandon the Acolytes in the Arctic now.
Fuck, maybe they'll have to find a fart ghost like Gambit did in the Antarctic. Or maybe it's one of those things, like, where there are penguins and then there's, like, the other kind of seabird, like, in the Arctic and Antarctic. Like, maybe Antarctica has fart ghosts and Arctic has, I don't know, fart revenants.
Burp ghosts.
Or burp ghosts, that's true. It could be a different, like, somewhat unappealing bodily function.
Either way, just unappealing ghosts.
The worst ghosts, just the absolute worst ghosts. That's why you should never go to the North or South Pole, because of the fucking ghosts.
Just they're just terrible. Like, they're not even cool ghosts.
That reminds me of the old Ghostbusters toys, the real Ghostbusters toys from, like, when we were growing up. I specifically remembered that as the toy line went on, it just got weirder and weirder, as often happens. It happened with Ninja Turtles. But there was this one toy that was, like, a possessed toilet. Like, you know, it had, like, a mouth inside the lid. And, right? And in commercials, they had to, you know, show how the different toys worked. But you can't just show somebody dropping trowel to take a crap in a toilet only to find it's a ghost. Like, it's a kid's cartoon. And also, you couldn't remove the pants of the action figures, I guess. So instead, they just had Ray Stantz, like, wander over to a toilet and say, ah, I'm tired. I should just sit down and take a rest. And sit on the toilet. And then it, you know, tried to chomp him. But of all the places to sit down and take a rest, that doesn't seem like plan A, you know?
You know, it could be so much worse. It could be Silent Hill 2.
Oh, he just reaches right in.
Yep.
Anyway, terrible ghosts that may be toilets very much aside.
Man, where were we? I just completely lost my train of thought there.
That was pretty distracting, it's true. Let's see. So the X-Men didn't die in the Arctic. They were protected from the nuke. Oh, right. They did get kind of knocked all around, though. I do enjoy that Nightcrawler and Colossus are all uncomfortably tangled. And, like, so are Gambit and Rogue. And Gambit's just insisting that he's paralyzed from the impact as he lays down on Rogue's chest. And she's sort of rolling her eyes, amused. It's actually very cute.
Wah, wah. Now, you mentioned Colossus and his metal form and how it was interacting with the electromagnetic fuckery. And Colossus is very aware of this. So he stays in human form while he's fighting the acolytes for most of the fight. And this fight goes on longer than it really needs to, but there's a really, really kick-ass moment where he finally goes metal and channels all of that ambient electrostatic electricity to knock out most of the acolytes.
Oh, maybe that's what he does in the X-Men arcade game, where he, like, you know, raises his arms in the air and goes, blah! And then, like, energy goes everywhere and blows all the sentinels up around him.
Sure.
Blah!
Miles, you were very, very excited about, not the Colossus moment, but a Wolverine line in the fight.
Oh, yeah, he talks about how they need to distract the acolytes for long enough, or the plan can take a hike. The claws are coming out. And Dr. Payne will start filling out prescriptions.
Is Dr. Payne like Dr. Medicine? Will he prescribe a bear?
Possibly. I bet Logan's hung out with some bears in his time.
Of both varieties.
Exactly. Anyway, how do they get out of this?
Well, someone tosses Kitty up onto the ship. She takes out the one remaining acolyte there. And the X-Men just steal the acolyte's ship and ditch the acolyte's near the Arctic Circle, which is a major dick move.
Seriously, all that's up there is snow and ghosts.
Polar bears. I don't know what type of ghosts are Arctic, but polar bears are definitely Arctic, and they will definitely just eat the acolytes for fun.
That's why there's so many ghosts up there. Everybody keeps getting eaten by polar bears, and all that's left? Fart ghosts.
So there was years and years, decades and decades and decades ago, there was a National Geographic special about animals at play. And one of the stories in there was about this Arctic research station that had a dog. And the dog was outside and a polar bear approached it. And they were like, oh, shit, that's the end of that dog. But the polar bear was just like trying to play with it. And the dog was down with this because apparently it lacked self-preservation instinct. And this happened regularly. Like this polar bear would come back. And on days when it was too cold for the dog to come out, the polar bear would just like come and wait dolefully for it.
Aww.
But that polar bear was an exception, a mutation, as it were.
Warlock's the only kind technarch, so is this polar bear the only kind polar bear?
No, this polar bear's the only kind technarch.
Weird.
Right? Anyway.
The point is Magneto has been nuked, and we should not ignore that, because remember, he's been in communion with the Earth's magnetosphere, which I'm pretty sure if he like did a residency in Vegas, that would be the structure he did it in. So that's not great.
Now, dealing with the resulting chaos distracts Magneto enough that he doesn't sense Joseph and Astra approaching, and Astra just doesn't stop being mean to Joseph.
The whole time! It's great!
Understand this, Joseph. I have as much respect for your feelings, needs, and desires as I would for those of my VCR.
As alluded to earlier, there it is. So, as Astra finally confronts Magneto for the first time in a long time, and we just don't really get much more of her backstory. It's the same thing. Magneto is somehow abusive to her, which, I mean, fair enough, he was awful in the past, but we don't really get any details, we don't really get any history, and so it's kind of hard to find Astra all that sympathetic, like, with literally no information. I wish we got more, but I at least do like what a snarky shit she is to Magneto here.
Let's recap. You show them why it's in their best interest to let you rule them. Surprise! The cattle disagree and fight back. Oh, look, you get offended and righteous. You'll show them. You'll take away their electric razors. Yep, I have seen this before.
Anyway, they yell at each other back and forth a lot.
And Astra then blows up the machines Magneto had been using to amplify and moderate his magnetospheric manipulations. This is a problem because it means that the entire power of the magnetosphere is channeling through Magneto and seriously risks outright destroying Earth's atmosphere. Astra, for her part, does not give a fuck, and Magneto would just as soon zap that energy at her, effectively discharging it, but Joseph is down to scrap.
Because see, that's the thing. As terrible as Astra is to him, as much as he just wants to go back to being a hero, he can't. When Astra created Joseph, she created him in such a way that he was inherently loyal to her, that he couldn't resist.
But he's also still fundamentally opposed to what Magneto is doing, as he says.
I believe in Charles Xavier's dream. I am what you would have been had you not been blinded by loss and anger.
And you can kind of see that, because one of the things that really distinguishes Joseph from Magneto is the length and general glamness of his hair. And the other place we've seen Magneto with that hair is, of course, the Age of Apocalypse, where he radically rethought his position after the assassination of Charles Xavier.
I mean, yeah, like, you partially jest, but you're totally right. Like, that has become visual shorthand for Magneto being a better guy. When he has longer hair, that's often the case.
See the new animated series.
So it's a whole thing. We'll get to that later. Anyway, the UN is being all warlike because, to be fair, Magneto is actively destroying the Earth at present.
But they have called in a consultant. That is Dr. Alda Huxley of Genosha. She's named, obviously, after Aldous Huxley. And she is very excited about this, very excited about the opportunity this creates. She has a solution, she thinks, to everyone's problem, which brings us to X-Men number 87, No Surrender, in which, spoilers, surrendering occurs.
This issue is plotted by Alan Davis, scripted by Fabian Nicieza, penciled by Alan Davis, inked by Mark Farmer, colored by Marie Javins and Gloria Vasquez, and lettered by Richard Starkings and Comicraft and Saida Tamafonte. Oh, more Alan Davis pencils. Hooray. Also, a trick I never get sick of, which is when the stakes are really high, you open with a news report describing the high stakes.
So do you prefer the news report describing the high stakes, or like the big video conference with a lot of major characters you haven't seen in a long time and always Super Doctor Astronaut Peter Corbeau?
Well, I'll never be mad about Dr. Corbeau showing up, as seldom as that happens. In this case, I think this works, though. You know, we have Trish Tilby, the reporter that covers seemingly everything related to the X-Men. But it does actually make me think of a third way of opening momentous stories, which is with the Watcher describing it. Like, he does that with the Dark Phoenix saga, you know? And that just makes me want some kind of a workplace sitcom where Uatu the Watcher and Trish Tilby are like rival reporters for different networks, each trying to get the scoop on these big, like, earth-shattering events.
So there's an episode of Jane the Virgin where she gets involved with this guy who is the protagonist of, or nominally the protagonist of his own telenovela, and has a narrator, and she still has a narrator, and their narrators sort of clash.
Oh, that's amazing. I love that concept.
Jane the Virgin is an awesome, awesome show. I don't know if I've talked about it on this podcast before, but if you look at it superficially, like, it does not look like the kind of thing I would recommend. But it is some of the best meta-based genre commentary while being some of the best, like, character and story soap opera out there. It's so, so good.
Okay, high praise. Yeah, I knew, like, nothing about that.
It has definitely made me cry, and it's also among the funniest things I've ever seen, and also just genius.
I love that combination. Humor and crying? Two of my favorite things.
Oh, Miles, you would love it. It is full of the dramas. Because it's a telenovela, but it's a telenovela that's also about telenovelas and telenovela culture and the way that being a telenovela fan influences the way you interact with the rest of your life. But what if your life is actually as fucked up as a telenovela?
Oh, that's so great and meta.
It's really brilliant.
Oh, well, what's also brilliant is the Alan Davis penciled double page title spread near the start of this issue, because it is just Magneto and Joseph, who are these super heroic, colorful, handsome, of course, titans battling. And like, there's this big energy blob of pink magnetic glory in between them that they're clearly each trying to gain control over since their powers are identical. And you can just see Astra sort of cackling madly in the background. And of course, the narration has to match the art, and indeed it does.
Huddled in darkness, the world awaits salvation. While the man who controls their fate for good or bad, Magneto, the mutant master of magnetism, struggles to save himself. It would be so easy to let go, Magnus thinks.
abandon the restraints of his body and become a living part of the magnetic storm seductively calling out to him. But to do so would mean the end of Earth.
God damn it, Magneto War. I was so prepared to not like you at all, and then you pull something like this on me.
It's a Magneto story. It's fun. It's high drama. It's just way too stretched out. It's not a bad story. It's not a bad concept. There's just too much of it.
Once again, that's the thing. Like, some of the moments are just so goddamn good. Like, Alan Davis and Fabian Nicieza, these are two people with an incredibly long history between the two of them on various X-books. Like, they know what they're doing. And yeah, I know it was just sort of a workmanlike job. They were called in kind of last minute after Steve Siegel and Joe Kelly quit. And so obviously that's going to lend some constraints. They were also, you know, being told how the story was supposed to go by other people. But still, they're kind of killing it in little moments like this.
So the X-Men approaches, meanwhile, in their stolen ship with a plan. They're going to break into three groups. One is going to hold back each combatant, you know, Joseph and Magneto. One will restrain Astra.
And that last part happens almost immediately, because as they enter the eye of the electromagnetic storm, apparently electromagnetic storms also have eyes, like hurricanes, Nightcrawler is able to make his teleportation work right and just yoinks Astra away, or I guess bamfs Astra away. And as he teleports her far, far away, she speaks in German, implying that she knew Nightcrawler when he was a child. And like most things Astra-related, this will never be mentioned again.
Wolverine, Rogue, Gambit, Shadowcat, and Marrow go after Magneto.
And he has no patience for any of them.
Particularly Gambit. And the X-Men don't know, and probably won't find out for a while, that the Eric the Red who was presiding over Gambit's trial in the Antarctic was in fact Magneto.
A betrayer of his own kind. You are so contemptible, Gambit. You do not even warrant my attention.
But I mean, you just said, wait.
To Magneto's credit, when Marrow yells at Magneto about never having helped the Morlocks if he thinks he likes mutants so much, Magneto says, yeah, you're right, and I've long been ashamed of that fact, and I want to fix it.
Good. So Xavier, Storm, and Colossus go and find Joseph. And Joseph is already trying to repair the magnetosphere now that Astra's not close enough to control him. But as he does, he's doing exactly what Magneto was concerned about doing in that opening narration. He is himself disintegrating into the EM spectrum as he tries.
Because remember, one of the differences between Joseph and Magneto is that Astra built Joseph to not have any limits on his powers, even when using his powers at a certain level would destroy him. But the X-Men aren't about to let that happen. It is time for a Chrono Trigger-style triple tech. Xavier anchors Joseph's mind to the material world, and Colossus goes all metal to attract all the electromagnetic energy and also probably says, "Arr!" And then Storm channels it back into Joseph's body as Joseph zaps it into the sky. Does this make sense? I don't know. It doesn't have to make sense if it's awesome.
Miles, literally none of the science in this story makes sense. It's just cool.
And that is like 100% fine. We do not need to overthink it. I'm as much of a fan of the whole like official handbook for the Marvel Universe thing where it tells you exactly where Hawkeye stores whatever little type of arrow in his hover cycle as anybody. But sometimes you can just throw a lot of science words around, and if it's emotional and earnest enough, like, it doesn't even matter which words.
Sometimes an arrow just happens to have a boxing glove at the tip, and right, it still flies.
Don't overthink it.
Now, Joseph is still tempted to just let himself dissipate into the magnetosphere, to become part of the greater whole to protect the Earth, or possibly to fuck the Earth, as the art seems to show.
Yeah, there's like a giant naked Joseph with extra long hair and his eyes all white, holding the Earth in front of him, it's maybe the size of a beach ball compared to him and his network of energy. It actually looks pretty awesome. It's just Alan Davis having fun. And Joseph starts to slip away. And what we see physically is that his body is just aging more and more and more until he looks older than the actual Magneto, as he just channels all of this power through himself. But it seems okay. Like, Alan Davis draws such a satisfied, wistful smile on Joseph's face, and you see just a single tear fall as he smiles at the X-Men around him, and then he's gone.
And that brings me back to my no prize explanation of his beard.
Right, I almost forgot.
Because Joseph doesn't have limits. He doesn't have natural or reflexive limits to his use of his power. And using it at high enough levels ages him rapidly.
Oh.
And he was going all out to fight Magneto. I don't think it makes sense that the beard would have grown after he fell, but I think it makes sense that it would have grown over the course of the fight.
Okay, I just love this idea, though, because it's almost like in Dragon Ball Z, rip Akira Toriyama, where, you know, all the characters go Super Saiyan and, like, their hair gets all blonde and spiky, but apparently the X-Men equivalent of going Super Saiyan is just growing a big fuck-off beard.
I mean, it works for Iceman.
It does work for Iceman. He turned into an ice wizard that one time. I mean, you know, in the future, but still.
The best future? I mean, not actually the best future, but definitely the future where he has the best beard.
Right, which, you know, that's worth a lot right there.
It's where he keeps his magic.
Bringing it back. Astra returns, all petty and annoyed, having gotten back through, I don't know, some weird alien technology probably. And she sees that everything has gone pear-shaped in terms of her plans and just teleports back into barely ever being mentioned again.
Thank God. Now, we've brought Magneto and Xavier to the same place for the first time since Xavier wiped Magneto's mind. And they have a very, very tense showdown.
Xavier sums up the cycle of their conflict.
A parry to your thrust, to a human parry, to a mutant thrust. And so it ever goes in an endless, useless cycle of thrusting and thrusting and thrusting and thrusting.
Okay, some of that's on the page. Most of it's just implied.
But before the fight can resume, a UN airship, because the UN has a budget in this world, lands with Ferris, Magneto's robot buddy, alongside. And Magneto correctly assumes that because Ferris is there, it means that he has won. And the UN has decided that they will, in fact, give him a country. And so they do.
What's interesting here is that they didn't have to. Magneto, his plans had been, you know, destroyed. He had failed in his plans. And Alda Huxley, the ambassador to Genosha, or from Genosha, one of those, she knew that. She got a report from one of her underlings that, like, Magneto had been defeated and they could just abandon the whole appeasement plan. And she burned the report. She has very specifically decided she wants Magneto to take over Genosha. And indeed, that's the country the UN gives him, which is very, very interesting.
It's extremely interesting, and I find it extremely funny that the Genosian government is just like, we don't want to have to deal with this anymore, and this is the easiest way to just wash our hands of it.
Yeah, yeah. So Genosha, of course, was an apartheid metaphor. It was a nation where mutants were essentially an enslaved underclass. There was an uprising. Now it's much better than it was. And also now it's going to be run by Magneto. And this is going to be a whole thing. We are going to get much more into this when we cover the Magneto Rex miniseries very soon. But in the meantime, the X-Men are very upset. And in fact, Logan tries to murder Magneto to, prevent the turnover of a country. And Professor Xavier has to put him to sleep, which I assume he does by just sort of putting a blanket over his head like he's a parakeet.
Well, this is the first time Logan's been in contact with Magneto that he knows of since Magneto ripped his adamantium out. He has been spoiling for some blood since the fight started.
Oh, you know, that is a really good point. Like, as much as Xavier has complicated and very painful feelings toward Magneto after Fatal Attractions, I mean, Logan got his freaking skeleton ripped out, or at least the metal parts of it, which, you know, just as bad, basically. And we've talked about this before. It's easy to just figure, whatever, he can heal from anything. But, like, think about that. Getting every part of the substance that coated your bones pulled out through parts of your body that are not supposed to have bones pulled through them? Like, the issue where that happened really gets across the sheer mind-destroying agony of it. So, yeah, that berserker rage, that is right the fuck here. And so here we are. Here we are at the end of the Magneto War, which, you know, is all right. It leads us into a new era where Alan Davis is kind of running the show for a while, as much as he's allowed to. And here we also are at a plot point that in a lot of ways will lead us directly into Grant Morrison's fateful run a couple of years after this. This is like the first big thing that run will pull from.
But before that run happens, you've got questions. Devin emailed us to ask, so when the X-Men play Barbarella, Storm is Barbarella, Callisto is the Black Queen, and Angel is Pygar, how would you go out filling out the rest of the cast, Dildano, the Catchmen, the Evil Twins, etc.? I can only assume that Sinister would play Dr. Duran Duran, but correct me if I'm wrong.
Ah, the X-Men Barbarella overlap, one of my favorites. Listeners, as you may recall, Callisto, the big Callisto story, involved her capturing Angel and the X-Men having to go down there to rescue him. Storm and Callisto end up dueling. And that whole story is a big riff on the old movie Barbarella, Queen of the Galaxy, based on an old European comic. Callisto basically is the Black Queen, the villain from, well, villain kind of, from Barbarella. And Angel basically is the angel from Barbarella, a guy named Pygar. Devin, I agree. The sort of mad scientist guy, Dr. Duran Duran, that the band did indeed name themselves after, is straight up Mr. Sinister. Similar vibes.
Oh, yeah.
So as far as the other characters, and I will try to go through this list in a way where if you're not familiar with Barbarella, which a lot of people sadly aren't, it'll make some sense. There is Mark Hand, the Catchman. He's this rugged, hairy-chested hero who rescues Barbarella at one point and teaches her the ways of earthly love in a sort of, like, daddy-ish but very gentle fashion. Yeah, that's totally Banshee. That is obviously Banshee.
I feel like there's a case to be made for Wolverine on that one, but I'll go with your answer.
You know, I just see him as more of a Banshee. I don't know, but fair enough. Certainly Wolverine's hairy enough. Exactly. The creepy children with their evil bitey dolls that they send to attack Barbarella. Those are two ex-characters that not everyone may remember. Maxime and Manon, they're these creepy young French siblings from the late 2010s who betrayed the X-Men and ended up being pretty central in the whole extermination storyline that ended up sending the time-displaced teen X-Men back in time. Them. Professor Ping, the inventor in the Maze of Lost Souls who can repair pretty much anything. So I would say Forge because he has a similar cobbling stuff together style. But this is a character that doesn't hit on Barbarella, one of the few in the movie. And, well, obviously Forge and Storm had a thing, so I'm just going to go ahead and say this is Dr. Nemesis.
Wizkid.
There's also Wizkid, that's true. But Wizkid has this sort of snarky self-awareness that Professor Ping really doesn't. That is more Dr. Nemesis's style. Dr. Nemesis doesn't worry about human interaction too much. The delightfully named Dildano, the leader of the resistance to the bad guys, who's like super into having pill-based non-physical sex, like, you know, the proper kind that he's heard about with Barbarella. I mean, you can guess, right, Jay?
Oh, yeah, Shinobi Shaw, all the way.
Oh, yeah, Dildano totally knows what pill-based sex is. And, of course, there's this big evil force behind all of the evil stuff that ends up being the big villain. That is the Matmost. It's like this amorphous dark blob that powers the evil city with the concept of evil. So, yep, that is the Shadow King. The Shadow King is behind Barbarella, Queen of the Galaxy.
Okay.
So, Ben and also a lot of people contacted us to ask what we thought of X-Men 97, the new cartoon. And I should note here that we are recording this as only 3 episodes of it are out, so our answer will reflect that fact.
So, I think it's a lot of fun. As those of you who've been listening to the show for a long time know, I don't really have any particular nostalgic ties to the 92 animated series, so I can't really speak to how well it may or may not appeal to those. What I think it does do a great, great job of capturing, though, is the original's audacity of scope when it comes to adapting the apparently unadaptable. Like, this show does things consistently, or has done things consistently in the first 3 episodes that make me go simultaneously, wait, you did that? And then, wait, that worked?
Freaking for real, yeah. I mean, that can make for some odd pacing for condensing some rather massive storylines into not a whole lot of screen time. But so far, I kind of feel like they've stuck the landing. I was especially impressed with the second episode. And we'll try not to spoil anything here. But suffice to say, the second episode crams, like, so much plot into under a half hour and does it in a way that is, like, genuinely emotionally effective, despite still feeling like a Saturday morning cartoon in a lot of ways. I was blown away by the ability of the show to do that. Like, this show didn't need to be as good as it is. It could have just been sort of a nostalgic cash-in, and that would have been basically fine, but it's, like, genuinely pretty great.
Well, you're just excited because your voice actor crush plays Jean.
Yeah, yeah. Jennifer Hale, Commander Shepard herself, is playing Jean Grey and doing it so well.
And they got Lenore Zann back as Rogue, which is great. Doubly great because her day job these days is progressive Canadian politician.
Maybe she retired? I don't actually know. But yeah, it's delightful. Like, it's got all the nostalgia, of course, except it looks way better. I rewatched the finale of the original series to prepare for it, and oh man, in my head it looked a lot better and sounded a lot better.
It's rough, man. It's rough.
But the new one does. Like, they redid the same opening. You know, there's some modifications, some new characters and stuff, but it's still got the same vibe. And looking at it side by side with the old one, man, it's higher quality. Everything is, but it's still got the same style. I'm kind of blown away, honestly.
I'm actually really enjoying the combination of the retro vibe and the fact that I have no fucking idea where it's going. Like, they very, very early on, again, with that same audacity of scope, established that this is not an X-Men whose continuity you have encountered before.
Very much so, yeah. And as much as they're working in a lot of the stories from the comics, like the original series did, sort of the causality and the order and the meaning of it all, that's unique to this show's continuity. We are a fully listener-supported podcast, and certain levels of support come with on-air acknowledgement from various fictional characters and concepts. So it's been a while. Let's tune the dial to ZZ105.
You've been listening to 5 hours of atonal but culturally relevant humming, only on ZZ105. This and other programming is brought to you by the Frost Foundation for the Combustion of Ponies, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and by listeners like Nate Randall and Joe, who are enjoying their contributor-exclusive ZZ105 hookahs.
And with that,
Jay and Miles Explain the X-Men is recorded in Forest Hills, New York and Portland, Oregon, and produced by Matt Hunter, who also arranged our theme music. You can find more of Matt's work at moon-talk.bandcamp.com.
New episodes come out most Sundays on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at explainthexmen.com.
Check out explainthexmen.com for visual companions to every episode.
Our show is 100% listener-supported. If you'd like to help us stay in the air and ad-free and maybe get a hookah, but probably not, check out the Patreon link at the top of explainthexmen.com.
And please, take a moment to rate and review us on your favorite podcasting platform. It really helps.
In 2 weeks, Generation X meets Nate Gray.
And everyone makes choices that are exactly as good as you'd expect.